You're listening to the Mentoring Developers Podcast, episode 67. Come on in.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
In this episode of Mentoring Developers, I'll be talking to Jeremy Clark. Jeremy is an application developer, he's a technical speaker, and he's also a Microsoft MVP with over 13 years of experience. He also likes to put together demos and technical articles for jeremybytes.com, which is a website focusing on .NET technologies. When he is not doing all of that, he can be found shredding on a plastic guitar, or playing a real guitar fairly badly. He lives in Anaheim, California, with a seedling redwood tree and his cats, Amanda and Toby. All right, get ready for my interview with Jeremy Clark. It's going to be great. Hi, everyone. Today, my guest is Jeremy Clark. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's so good to have you. And I was going through your profile, your website, and some of the information I found about you when we set you up for this interview. And I was really amazed, not only that it seems you've done a lot of quality work and you are a teacher and a mentor, but you've done a lot of it, a lot of different types of things. So I really want our audience to get to know you and to understand where you're coming from and how did you manage all that. But first, I want to hear from you the story of how you got into independent consulting, because I hear that was not planned, but you just fell into it somehow. How did that happen?
Yeah, so not planned at all. So I spent the bulk of my development career as a corporate developer and at the Disneyland Resort, and it was a great place to work. And I never saw myself as someone who would do contracting or consulting work because I am not a risk taker, right? So I'm like, I need that regular paycheck every week, you know, even though, you know, technically having a job is sort of an illusion of safety. You know, we never know if the next paycheck is actually coming. But, you know, I always felt like I need that security and I couldn't go, you know, months between paychecks and not knowing where my next meal is coming from and things like that. So, you know, I always saw myself as, you know, I'm going to sit here and get a regular paycheck and that's the way that it's going to be. And it's interesting because kind of through a series of small steps, you know, I ended up independent, which is kind of scary. So kind of my first step was I left that corporate job and worked for a startup. And part of that was, you know, it was kind of time to transition to something new. And during that time, you know, I managed to save up some money and, you know, kind of live within my means, which is always a good challenge to do. And I also kind of burnt myself out at that startup. And when I got to the end of my time there, you know, it's like, okay, I need to move on to something new. I'm burnt out. I'm going to need to relax. And I had a friend who said, Jeremy, you need to quit your job without having a new job. And I'm like, what? You want me to quit my job without having a new job? But she just kind of went through it. You know, at the time I was a senior developer, which is always a good place to be. There was good demand for my kind of work. And then plus I did kind of need a break before I started something new. And so, you know, during that time, I started to pursue teaching because that's what I really wanted to do is I love to help other developers and make developers better. And so, you know, I pursued a couple different paths. I tried to get into classroom teaching and, you know, spent some time with that. And that didn't quite work out the way I planned. And, you know, I ended up taking a contract job in the meantime to kind of, you know, fill up the bank account a little bit more. And then I ended up with an opportunity to do a Pluralsight course. And again, this was a great opportunity for me because I knew, you know, I wanted, again, to get into teaching and I figured this would be a good way to show what I can do. And I wasn't really looking at it as a, you know, kind of a financial solution. I was more looking at it as a marketing and brand building kind of thing, you know, because I get my name in the Pluralsight catalog next to these famous people and, you know, there's a little bit of street cred for me. And it turned out that my first course kind of did unexpectedly well financially. And that gave me the opportunity to do some more courses and pursue some other things. And I haven't had a regular paycheck for like 4 years now, which is really weird. Because again, that whole security thing, you know, it turns out that sometimes you can still have the security even though you don't necessarily have your next gigs coming. And a lot of this was because I started speaking in the community. And so I started speaking at local code camps and then started speaking at some regional events in different parts of the US and then started speaking at professional events and international events. And it's, you know, it's been an interesting trip because, you know, here I am independent. And in January of this year, I actually went to Iceland for a consulting gig, you know, based on, you know, people who had found out about me through various channels. So I look back at my life and it's like, okay, back in 2010, I was sitting in a cube farm, you know, programming, which again, it was a great job. But now I look at my life and it's like, okay, now I'm flying to Iceland to go spend a week talking with this team of developers. So again, it wasn't intentional, but because of the way things worked out, you know, it's just kind of where I ended up. And it's really cool. I'm very happy with where I am because it does give me an opportunity to share what I know with other developers and just kind of make our community better.
It's interesting that we have so many different paths that we could potentially follow as software developers. When you're starting out, when you're just a new developer, when you're in high school, or maybe you're switching jobs and you just want to be a programmer or a software developer, you really know what options you can have or what are the different things you can do. And that's some of the struggles that my audience here suffers from, right? We just don't know what we don't know. And so one benefit of having you on this podcast, Jeremy, is that they can find out that there are other things they can do. If they live in an area where there are not a lot of jobs, then they have one option. They can become consultants or do independent work. In your case, not only that you are consulting at clients that are far away places, you're probably also consulting remotely sometimes. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
So you have the opportunity to work from home, and you also have the opportunity to create courses that now they sell, and then you don't actually actively have to do any work. They just make money for you passively. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The passive income, it's really great because that basically is covering my living expenses right now. And so it's nice because what that means is now I can put my effort into other pursuits, you know, again, whether it's having the opportunity to travel to different parts of the country to speak with different developers, whether it's, you know, having the time and freedom to, you know, talk to coding schools or, you know, talk to different people on podcasts like yours. It's really nice because, you know, you kind of have that income that's coming in, but it's not something that you have to pursue on a daily basis. Now, with that said, I know some people who have had great success with it and some people who have had kind of moderate to minimal success with it. So I realize that the position I'm in is special, you know, so I'm very thankful of where I am. But again, I don't know if I would be able to actively pursue it and get to where I was. I kind of fell into it, right, which is nice.
So sometimes that happens to us. We set out to do something else and something else happens and it just makes more sense. And I've seen this happen again and again and again. In fact, I've seen that most successful people that we would call successful in the way we describe success, they fell into it. It's just incredible how many times I've heard that. And some people say, I lucked into it. Just random stuff happens to me. And they just do something that they really didn't think they should do. And it works. And then they drop everything else and they get on that bandwagon. I know some people have started companies making a product that they really didn't want to make, but they just accidentally made a product and it turned out to be their flagship product.
And I don't, you know, I hate to say that I lucked into it. There were a lot of things, again, I consider myself extremely fortunate for where I am, but there is also a lot of heading in a particular direction. Right. So kind of like when I said, you know, I really want to pursue sharing my knowledge with other developers, you know, and I started out, you know, again, speaking at local code camps and user groups and starting a blog and doing some little YouTube videos and things like that. And even though I didn't end up, I'm not exactly sure where I expected to end up. I didn't end up where I expected to end up, but it's definitely kind of along the same direction. So I don't think it's just purely random chance. I think a lot of it is you kind of create your own luck. You know, it's like get out there and talk to people and find out what's going on. And you kind of sort of generate your own luck. A good example of that is when I was at that startup, you know, and again, I came to the end of my time there because of some changes that were happening in the company. And it turned out that I had put in my notice at that company the weekend before a code camp. So I'm at a local code camp that weekend in Southern California and talking to the people that I just knew from the community. And during that time, seriously, I had a half dozen people who said, oh, you're available? You know, talk to us. You know, we have openings at our company. And I actually had like six leads come out of that. And that was from people that I knew in the developer community, just talking to them and meeting them at meetups and user groups and things like that. So, you know, kind of that network of people I didn't know before has been hugely influential in my career as well.
I think that the key is that you are out there speaking and you're putting yourself out there. First of all, people know you to be knowledgeable and technically efficient. Right, they know that you can do the job because of the teaching that you do and the writing that you do and the speaking that you do. And then after that, you are getting in front of people. And if you hadn't done that, if you had the same technical acumen and the same ability, but you weren't out there speaking, if you weren't on this podcast, or if you weren't writing blogs, then I think you would find yourself in a different situation. You may not have the exposure or the leads. So to your point, we really have to put ourselves out there if we want to make a change in our lives. Because a lot of developers that I talk to and that I've known personally, they would like to change their situation. Maybe they would like to grow professionally, or maybe they would like to get into consulting. But they don't have people coming to them. People don't know them, right? They don't have a name. So that's where a lot of us struggle. And what I would like to know is, for somebody who is, let's say, somebody who's been working in the field for a few years and they feel like they're at a place where they would like to pursue going independent and finding their own work and maybe making courses for Pluralsight or some other website, or maybe finding their own clients to do their client work. But they don't have a name. People don't know them. People don't recognize them. They don't have an MVP award. What could they do? Is it possible for those people to pursue the path that you're on, or do they have to do all the things that you did first?
That is a really good question. And I have a lot of colleagues who are also kind of, I will say, on similar paths that I am, but everyone kind of has their own pace that they go with. So definitely getting out there somehow. You know, the first thing I would say is find a local meetup. Just talk to other people who are in your developer community, but not people you directly work with. That is one thing that was huge to just kind of opening my eyes to what's available out there. But when it came to speaking, again, I just kind of said, I didn't used to think that I had anything to share because I was, you know, a corporate developer sitting at a desk. And I don't want to use the term corporate developer like it's a negative thing, because I was an awesome corporate developer. But, you know, I'm writing line of business applications, nothing world changing. I was affecting my users' lives, but, you know, nothing really hugely exciting. And I always thought, you know, I would love to, like, you know, speak and share and this and that. You know, I would go to these big conferences and I'm like, oh, it'd be awesome to be up on that stage and talking to people. But what do I know? Right. And I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about specifically in the .NET world, which is kind of where I live these days. And they're saying, oh, you know what? When .NET first came out, everybody was talking about the basics because C# was a new language and .NET was a new environment, you know, and garbage collectors and how the classes work and how the language works. But then years later, now that it's been established, people are just talking about, oh, here's the latest new technology in .NET, you know, and nobody's covering the basics for bringing new developers into the environment or, you know, either brand new programmers or people who are coming over from other environments. And I was like, you know what? I can do that. I can teach those basics. You know, I've got a good handle on them and a good way of explaining them. And I took that as a challenge and I signed up to speak at a code camp that was coming up a few months later. And that's how I got started. Since then, you know, I got hooked on speaking. I loved it. I realize it's not for everybody, but I do encourage people to try it at least once. And if there's something that's holding you back, you say, you know what? I don't know enough to get up on stage in front of people. You know, I don't know enough. I'm not an expert. Well, here's the secret. None of the speakers are experts either. The thing is, you have something that you know that can help somebody else. Whenever I'm, you know, talking to somebody and trying to encourage them to say, hey, you know what, go share something you know. I say, think about something that you wish you had known 6 months ago, right? It's that thing that you struggled through and you finally got over the hurdle and you're like, this is great. I wish somebody had told me about this 6 months ago. That is your topic. You know, you don't have to know everything about everything. All you have to know is one thing more than the people that you're talking to, and you can be helpful.
Now, this is really great advice for everybody listening right now. This is incredible because you always have something to teach. I give you an example of my 7-year-old kid. She is she has been programming on Scratch for a couple of years, so it's not really coding the way we think about it, but it's programming. And now she's at a point where she's comfortable teaching her little sister, her 3-year-old sister, something on Scratch Junior or just a few things of how things work.
And, yeah, that's awesome.
And now, you know, she's a teacher. And I'm also in the process of, I started a new teaching class at a K-8 school, local school here, where I'm teaching kids programming, and I want to start some awareness in the parents and the students themselves that computer programming is a valid and legitimate thing that they can pursue just for fun or for a career, but it's something that exists. And when I was a kid, I didn't know it existed, so I had to struggle. So I'm trying to teach them, and my daughter is in there, and I know that when it comes time to do some projects, she's going to be over there and helping the kindergartners and first graders, right? Even people her age, because she's been doing it for over a year. So she's actually feels comfortable. That's incredible for me to think about, because since she was a kid, I have been trying to get her into programming, but she wasn't interested. But as soon as she started doing it, now, for as far as that particular thing that she's working on, she is an expert to all the kids that are younger than her.
Right.
And if I put a camera in front of her and I say, can you talk about what you just learned yesterday? Or can you talk about how you made this program? She can totally talk about it. And for all the other kids that have never actually seen any programming, that will be very valuable. And that's just, it opens up, you know, a lot of avenues in my mind. Like, hey, this is, all of us can do this, right? A lot of us, we're just a little bit shy because we're thinking, what do we know? What do I know? Right.
Right. And I found some of my best articles that I have on my blog are things of me learning something new. You know, so I wanted to learn functional programming, and I took F sharp as one of the languages that I was working on. And I said, you know what, I'm going to go through the first 10 Euler problems, which those are kind of some standard, I would call them brain teasers, but just kind of things to, you know, try to program. You know, it's mostly mathematical kind of things, you know. You know, write a Fibonacci sequence and calculate the sum of the even numbers up to 100 or something like that. And so I said, I'm going to just try to do this with F sharp in a functional style programming, using functional style programming, and just kind of say, okay, here's the things I ran into. You know, here's where I ran into a roadblock, and here's how I got around it. And I've heard some great things about that series. You know, I was in another part of the country and someone's like, oh, Jeremy, you're going to do any more of those Euler problems? I've been following that series. And just having someone else say, hey, you know what, that thing you did is useful to me. And as far as like the Euler problems are concerned, those have been around for a long time. And there are literally thousands and tens of thousands of solutions to those in various languages. And people have done them in F sharp before. They've done them in all of the languages before. But just kind of putting my process out there of how I went through this has actually helped other people. And it's just really awesome to think that, you know, something that I would normally just be doing, you know, in my basement, you know, typical basement programmer, can actually impact somebody outside of that. And so you don't have to get up in front of people and speak. It might just be, you know what, I'm going to write some blog articles, or I'm going to put something out, you know, maybe a little YouTube video if you're more comfortable kind of talking and live coding things rather than writing. So there's a lot of things we can do to just kind of share what we know. Kind of that first hurdle that we have to get over, though, is that hurdle of being wrong, right? So in our industry, we just have this fear of being wrong. We have this fear of people saying, oh, you're doing it wrong. And so we just kind of have to put ourselves out there and say, you know what, I'm human, I'm imperfect. This is my thought process. And if you have a better idea, great, share it. If you want to rip me down, you know, go somewhere else. I don't want to hear about that. But, you know, part of it is just saying, you know, I'm going to put myself out there, and that's scary. And I'm going to get some comments I'm not going to like, but it's going to be totally worth it in the long run.
Right. You have to have somewhat of a thick skin, because people just love to bring everybody else down. It's incredible that it happens, but it happens on Twitter. It's going to happen anywhere people are able to post comments.
Yeah, and it really amazes me, because, for example, I have this video on YouTube, which is an introduction to test-driven development, right? Just an intro to TDD. And I got this drive-by comment. Someone's like, TDD is awful. And that was it. And I'm like, who is this person that just feels like they need to go to YouTube, find a random video, and say, this technology doesn't work? You know, it's just like, so you have to realize, first of all, you're not going to please everyone. And that was a really tough thing for me to get over, especially when I was speaking and getting up in front of people. But then kind of as you do it enough, you're going to find your audience. You're going to find those people that you're targeting. And it took me kind of many years to kind of refine it and hone into it. But it's like, you know what? I know who my audience is now. So when I'm looking at places to speak, I'm not just kind of shotgunning it and saying, well, whoever will take me. I'm like, who are the people that I think are going to most benefit from what I have to say and the way that that I normally say it? And I know I'm not going to hit those cutting edge. I don't do bleeding edge new technology stuff. You know, that's not my thing. Other people are doing that. More power to them. But if I have kind of like, here's .NET programmers who want to get better, you know, that's basically my target audience. And there's a lot of people out there like that, which is nice. But now that I've been able to identify that, now I can, you know, when I get the comments of people who say, oh, this is too simple, this is too basic, I can say, you know what? Okay, that's fine. It's not for you, you know, but there's a lot of people who are getting a lot of benefit out of it. So being able to separate those, it's nearly impossible, because inside, I'm still crying inside when someone doesn't like me. But, you know, kind of that rational part of me says, you know what, let me focus on the people I'm trying to reach.
Right. It's hard to take. It's happened to me. It happens to everybody where somebody is just doesn't like you. And sometimes it's that. Sometimes they're just, you know, saying things they don't mean. So you have to have thick skin and you have to be able to focus on the positive people, people who give you positive energy versus people who are just pulling you down. So, and that's going to happen, as we said, it's going to happen everywhere, except if you are in a face-to-face environment where if you're giving a presentation, probably you will probably not get those comments from people that are actually present. But virtually, people like to throw all kinds of things at you.
And the nice thing about, I think code camps are an awesome place to start speaking if that's what you want, because first of all, it's free. So people aren't expecting things. And in fact, I always offer people a double your money back guarantee if they don't like my talk at code camp. And, and plus everybody in the room wants you to succeed. You know, it's like, they don't want to waste their hour, right? They don't want to sit there and waste an hour. They want you to succeed. They want to learn something from you. So everybody in the room is rooting for you. And again, not everybody is going to walk out getting what they wanted out of the talk or the presentation or whatever. And so, you know, again, generally there's a good positive energy in the room because nobody wants to be wasting their time. They want you to succeed.
I did want to ask you about Pluralsight. And also about the MVP award. Did you have the MVP when you approached Pluralsight?
Let's see. So timeline, yes, I was actually awarded an MVP before I did Pluralsight. As far as Pluralsight is concerned, they don't really care who you are. They want to know if you can teach. So that's one thing that I found was really nice. You know, they have an audition process and anyone can go through the audition process. You go to their website and there's a link somewhere on there that you can click to say, hey, I want to be an author. And you go through a process where basically they send you some instructions and you do a sample video and they want to see if you can teach. You know, that's all they care about. They don't care who you are. They want to know if you can teach. And as far as, you know, if you want to talk about the technical aspects of the presentations and whatnot, they do have a peer review system where other Pluralsight authors and people who are experts in those technologies will actually review for, you know, it's not 100% for correctness, but, you know, to make sure that nothing is way, way off when it comes to the technology. So the MVP and Pluralsight, it's an interesting mixture. The MVP award that I got, so MVPs are basically Microsoft recognizing people who contribute to the developer community. And so through my speaking and my blogs and things like that, that's actually why I was initially awarded that. And I've been an MVP for, I think I'm on year 6 now. So it's been really great. And again, so Pluralsight and MVP, they kind of both have interesting aspects to each other, but I would say one doesn't require the other.
Do you remember your first encounter with programming?
Yes, I do. And it's just because I was thinking about this a couple years ago. And I always thought, you know, my first experience with programming, oh, you know, my dad brought home an Apple II one day that he got left over from work and I started programming some BASIC and that was my first programming thing. But I'm like, you know what? That's totally not what it was. And this is going to tell how old I am now. So I apologize for that. I was like 3/4 gray beard, but I just shaved my beard. So I look a lot younger now. But
smart choice.
I traced back my first programming experience to Christmas of 1979, which seems a lot longer ago now. But I got this toy and it's called a Big Track. And what it was is it was basically a programmable tank, you know, so it's this tank that had six wheels and a little LED thing on the front. And it had a keypad on the back. It was a number pad. So it was like a number pad and some arrows. And you would punch in a program for what this thing is supposed to do. So you'd program it to go forward a certain number of lengths, you know, so each length of the vehicle. So I'd say go forward five lengths, and then you'd say, you know, turn right 90 degrees. And so, you know, turn right 90 degrees, go forward five, turn left 90 degrees, go forward five, and then fire the little fake laser thing at the front. And it was horribly frustrating. But I think that's how I found out I was a programmer, because first of all, there was no going back and fixing a program, because there was no display. So it was just programming in the thing and hitting go. there was no like go back and debug because line three was wrong. So I found that I was writing out my instructions on a piece of paper before I typed them into this little keypad. And then that was my first experience that real life doesn't always match theory. Because if you say go forward and turn 90 degrees, it might turn 85 degrees or 96 degrees, depending on what kind of surface it's on, because these were kind of hard plastic wheels. And if it was on carpet, it would do one thing. And if it was on tile, it would do something else and slide around a little more. So you find out, you say turn 90 degrees and it only turns 80 degrees and, you know, plows into the coffee table rather than going around it. So you go back and you debug it and say, oh, okay, well, I need to actually tell it to go 100 degrees because it's only going to go 90 on the surface. And, you know, I look back at this and I'm like, how did I ever survive that? That was just like a horrible programming experience. But I guess that was the time that I found out that I liked doing that kind of stuff and I wasn't completely frustrated by it.
I think some of my best experiences have been when I was young and I wanted to do programming. I didn't have access to a computer growing up, but I think back in the day we didn't have all these distractions, right? So we didn't have the iPhones and the iPads. We didn't have cable TV. I didn't have cable TV, and we didn't have anything. So all I had was, you know, what's in front of me. So that we have sort of lost that. I think it would be good if we could find a way to make things simpler again, at least for kids, so they can focus on things and not get distracted all the time.
Yeah, that's an interesting challenge, you know, and there's times where I'm like, oh, it's great. I have the entire internet open to me so I can solve this programming problem. But at the same time, part of me wants to go back to 1980, whatever, where, you know, I'm typing in basic instructions that were printed out in the back of a magazine, right? So you just type in these programs and you learn to debug based on how badly you typed and going through them. You know, and it's like, that's how we got programs. You know, there was no internet to download stuff from. You'd have to type them in yourself. And, I didn't have a lot. I always had like really old computers. So like that Apple II that I talked about, it was well past its prime by the time I got a hold of it. But, you know, it's great having a computer that you hook up to a television set. Oh, man, now I feel really old.
Yeah. Yeah, we've all heard about it or done it. I think we are lucky that we are in an era where we can have high definition screens on our desks just sitting there. And even 20 years ago, that would have been a stuff of dreams.
Oh, yeah.
So did you study computer programming, computer science, or any related field in a formal environment, either college or somewhere else?
No. And that was interesting because I am, for the most part, a self-taught programmer. So, you know, like I said, I kind of did hobby programming. My brother back in the day ran a bulletin board system, where you would basically modem into a specific computer, you know, to do stuff. That was quite a thing back in the day. So, kind of how I got started programming sort of for real is my brother actually worked for a software distributor, and he comes home one day and he drops this gigantic box in my room. And it says, he's like, okay, here's a compiler. And it was a C++ compiler. It was a Borland C++ compiler. And I installed it and was doing, command line compiles of C++ programs. And I ended up writing some little programs for his bulletin board, and it was just little, I wrote like a trivia quiz, a multiple choice trivia quiz kind of a thing. And it was fun, but it was kind of my first foray into programming for real. But in college, I was an English major, and I don't regret that at all because it taught me critical thinking skills that became very useful to me as a programmer. And then when I decided, hey, you know what, I want to do programming as a profession, my first thing was, I don't have any formal training. How am I going to get my foot in the door? And that was something that, again, I don't want to say I lucked into it, but I was kind of in the right place at the right time and kind of pursuing a particular path. And I ended up on the user side of a project. So I was working at the Disneyland Resort, and I was on the user side of this big resort-wide system that we were doing. And so I was in the requirements meetings, and I was actually building some little prototype things in Access so we can figure out what our requirements are. And the developer manager saw that I kind of had the right mindset. I was asking the right types of questions. And so she had a junior position open, and I said, yeah, that's awesome. I will take that. And this was, I would say I got started pretty late as a developer. I wasn't a professional developer until I was 29 years old. And most people would say, oh, you're practically over the hill at that point. Yeah. And that was just when I was beginning my professional journey. And I was very fortunate because that team that I ended up on was a very, they were focused on going forward, so everybody's thinking about how can we propel ourselves forward, meet our users' needs the best way we can. Everybody was sharing. So the senior developers were sharing with the people who knew less than they did. And so it was a really just inspiring growth environment. And I attribute kind of how rapidly I was able to progress as someone with no formal training due to that environment. And I wish more people could have access to that. But I do realize that that was a pretty rare experience that I got to go through. But it was awesome.
That's amazing that you had the opportunity. You found yourself in the right place at the right time. But I have actually heard a lot of people tell me similar stories, not exactly the same. But it turns out that if you work at a company that deals in technology or maybe has some technology, that they may need somebody to build some custom applications for them. It appears to be a common pattern. Some cases, they just need somebody to write some Excel, some Access type applications, something visual basic, something simple. In some cases, they may have websites, or in your case, it was more rigorous. But the lesson that I take from this is if you are out there and if you are, let's say you're doing something, you're a student and you want to do software development, you don't have any experience, you don't have any training, and you get a job at a different position, but you know that this company has a department where they hire developers. There is an opportunity for you to work within the system and then either apply for an open position or maybe have a good working relationship with the managers there in those departments. And I have seen this happen again and again, that people are able to go from something completely unrelated to software development or to testing, and then they work their way up. And eventually we all end up in the same place. Once you have a little bit of experience, then nobody asks how you got that experience or do you have a degree. Nobody asks, do you have a master's degree or do you have a PhD? Nobody asks that. I spent many years studying computer science and computer engineering. It turns out it wasn't needed to get a job at least. So I think that's a good lesson for all of us to learn, especially those of us that are listening to this podcast right now and they're a little apprehensive and they're getting a job somewhere. Go get the job. Having a job is important too. So being jobless is no fun.
Yeah, actually, so you were talking, you reminded me of kind of the steps before that, because when I started at the Disneyland Resort, I actually was taking hotel reservations. That was my first job there. Wow. And I remember there was a scheduling, I hate to use scheduling system, but basically, you know, the assistant manager was going through on an Excel spreadsheet and just typing in the schedule of everybody. And because of seniority and preferred positions and this and that, if somebody changed a position, she basically had to go through this big process of rearranging everything and kind of filling in the schedules again. And it was this huge manual process. And I took that and I'm like, you know what? I know some Excel, and I built a little pivot table, and it's like, okay, just type in the schedule into this little pivot table, and then it will turn it into the grid that you can then post on the wall. And it's little things like that where you can add value and save time that are valuable in the long run. I don't know that writing that little scheduling Excel spreadsheet really got me a programming job, but it was one of those small steps, you know, to show, first of all, to prove to myself that I can be technologically useful, and, you know, kind of to prove to other people, hey, you know what, this person's interested in being technologically useful. So yeah, there are some things that you can do, even if they're, you know, kind of technically outside your realm. You know, I see my job as a developer to just make the world a better place. And usually that's just making other people's jobs easier.
So you got your first job as a junior developer. You're excited. You have never done any programming. And you're 29 years old. And I don't know how people reacted to that. But a lot of people that I know would not react very positively necessarily to somebody else joining their company, their close-knit group sometimes, who has maybe no experience, right? It happens to a lot of us, and I've seen this happen, where getting accepted and being viewed as a valued member, an equal member, a contributing member to a team, takes some effort. How was the experience for you?
Well, like I said, I was on a very welcoming, open team. So I would say it's probably smoother than a lot of people go through. But one thing you do have to realize is that it will take time before your, I don't want to say pulling your own weight, because that makes it sound, you know, makes it sound like a horrible thing. But until you're like really useful in the department, you know, realize that when you're brand new to an area, you're going to be a drag on the area for a while. And so just be cognizant of that. And that's not necessarily just because I'm a new developer. It might be because I'm new to an industry, you know? So like when I took a contracting job in a completely different industry, I'm like, okay, I don't know anything about how these people's line of business works, you know? And so even though I was rock solid as a developer in the skills that they needed, I didn't know their business. And so as far as coming up to speed with, you know, okay, well, how does this work? How do they sign up new memberships? How do they do this? How do they do that? You know, it's always a learning process. And I think that the key to being successful as a developer is just absorbing knowledge. You know, you have to want to learn. And if you want to learn, you can learn the technologies, you can learn the business area, you can learn whatever the problem space is. You know, there's just so many things out there to learn. And as long as you're willing to do it and not necessarily have to, you know, if somebody has to keep handing you things and saying, oh, you need to learn this, you need to learn that, you need to learn this other thing, you're probably not going to be successful. But if you go and say, okay, what can I learn? What do I need to learn? And start actively participating in that experience, you know, now the other developers are going to see, okay, well, this person's serious. You know, it's not, they might be, you know, kind of a drag now, and they're asking me questions and they're not producing as much work as it's taking me to explain how to do it. But they've shown that they're interested in improving, and interest in improving and getting better and wanting to be, you know, a productive member of the team. That attitude really goes a long way to kind of softening those people who might be a little harder towards that.
So you were completely on your own, or did you have a mentor over there?
We didn't. Well, it was kind of weird because we sort of tried to set up a mentoring relationship where everybody was paired up in the department. But that formal thing didn't really last very long. So it was more of an informal thing. And it was basically kind of different people on the team had different areas of specialty, right? So when I first joined the team, I was given reporting, right? Because reporting is, first of all, it's pretty hard to delete data if you're doing reporting, right? So you're probably not going to mess that up. It is easier to hang a server, which I've done. I've hung servers while doing reporting before. But, you know, it's something you can approach and you kind of learn how the data is set up and how to get it on a piece of paper and things like that. And so, you know, during that initial process, I'm talking to the people who know the system, you know, the data that I'm working with, so I can, you know, find out how the relationships work and things like that. And then I'm also talking to the people who know the tool. You know, we were using Crystal Reports. So here's how the Crystal Reports tool works. And so I was able to kind of tap into these people to, you know, kind of do the different areas that I needed to learn, you know. And then eventually I was doing programming. We were using Delphi when I first started, and, you know, kind of doing some actual language programming in addition to my SQL is language programming, but, you know, set based versus whatever. you know, kind of getting more into the overall application space. And so it was more of an informal system where, you know, we were sharing with each other, and we would occasionally pair when we were running into problems. Something that I've learned now as a senior developer is I've heard about these teams that have a 15-minute rule, and I really like the idea of this. And the 15-minute rule is, before you ask somebody how to do something or for help with something, you have to spend at least 15 minutes looking for a solution on your own. You know, whether it's looking on Google or Stack Overflow or looking at the existing software that you have in your environment. And so you have to spend at least 15 minutes trying to find an answer before you ask someone else. So that gets you over the, I'm always asking somebody for help rather than trying to figure it out. But there's also a flip side to the 15-minute rule, which is if you spend more than 15 minutes looking for something, you have to ask for help. So that prevents people from getting stuck. And it also promotes, you know, kind of that sharing and asking environment. So someone doesn't sit at their desk just spinning for 2 hours stuck on a problem. You know, they ask for help, and other people are used to asking for help and giving help. Again, it does depend on your teammates wanting to be involved in that. But, you know, I like that idea of I'm doing some due diligence first. You know, I'm trying this on my own, but I'm realizing when I get stuck and I need someone else to help.
Yeah, that's really good advice, because I've seen both sides of the equation. I've been on both ends of this divide, right? I've been the one asking questions, and I've been the one being asked questions. And the problem is that the people that, if you're a new developer and you just started as a junior and you're trying to get an answer because you don't want to be embarrassed, or you want to really do well and you don't want to take a day to do something because you know that it should take only an hour. So you're thinking, okay, I'm just going to ask this person who obviously knows the answer, and then I'll be able to finish this task in time. The problem is that the person that you're asking also has his or her own tasks that right. They have to finish. And there, everybody's under the gun, right? That's what happens. And so they're probably, sometimes they're deep in their process. And if you interrupt them at that time, not only that it breaks their flow, and sometimes they may be working on something that gets delayed for them, which adds to their stress, which means that their response to you may not be as favorable. So I think it's a good idea to have some kind of a process. One of the companies I worked at, they had this umbrella process where, because it rained a lot in Chicago, everybody had umbrellas. So if the umbrella was on the desk, that means don't bother me. Mm-hmm. So that was funny. Yeah,
I like that. Well, and this is one of the things I miss about being in a cube environment. Because it's really easy, you know, I was in that environment for 11 years. And it's really nice when you can just pop your head up over the cube wall. And generally, you can just look at the person and figure out what's going on. You know, again, once you have some experience and you can see it, you can tell whether they're, you know, deep in meditation, you know, trying to solve a problem, or if they're just kind of sitting back and kind of looking at the whiteboard, or if they're, you know, talking to a client or whatever. So you can kind of get that visual of how busy is this person before you approach them. And that's something that, you know, as working remotely with people, I'm not quite as comfortable because I always feel like, oh, if I ping you on IM and you're deep in thought, I'm going to interrupt you. And I don't want to do that. So I do kind of miss popping my head over the wall and just being able to see, oh yeah, is this person available or not? And so yeah, that umbrella rule sounds pretty good.
If you could start over, is there anything you'd do differently?
So I learned a lot of things the hard way. And, you know, again, as someone who likes to help the next generation of developers, I love to tell people, you know, here's the problems I ran into and here's the things I wish I could avoid, but I know people aren't going to listen to me and they're going to have to go through those problems themselves. So like an example that I give is having to do with best practices. Now, before I say anything further, I hate the term best practices because it implies that this is the right thing to do in all circumstances. But at the other end of it, you know, when I was, you know, kind of a new developer, I knew everything, right? Because we all do. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, these best practices things. Yeah, those are nice, but you know, those are for like the academic people, you know, they're not really applicable to just normal programmers. And so I proceeded to make huge messes in some situations. And so after a period of time, I thought, oh, you know what? These people that have been programming 30 years longer than I have, maybe they have something that they know that I don't know. So I would encourage people to understand the best practices. And along that line, you know, I don't always follow them, but it's not because I don't know about them. It's because I said, okay, I know specifically that this does not apply to the situation that I'm in. So, you know, listen to your elders, I guess is the best way to put it. And I know now that I'm kind of one of the elders, you know, that's self-serving, but, you know, that's one thing that I wish I had paid more attention to when I was younger, just because there was, you know, one application in particular that it was the first solo application that I did, you know, so I had been working on team applications before, but my first solo application that I was given in this department, it was just a little reporting application, you know, and I was doing the start to finish little reporting application. And what I ended up doing was I ended up kind of putting all of the logic in the code behind of the main form of the application. And when I was building it, I'm like, oh, well, this is a simple application. It's not a big deal. But as it kind of got bigger and bigger and bigger, now I had, you know, a good 700 lines of code in the code behind of this one form. And I had to reap the benefits of that because I supported the application for many years. But it's one of those things where it's like, oh, I wish I could go back and do this again and kind of split up, you know, based on functionality, have these things in right, different places. So yeah, it's things like that. But again, I don't know if I would have learned my lesson without making that mistake. So I'm not sure what a good answer to that is.
Right. No, that's pretty good. And that, so I have two little girls and there's some debate, there's arguments between me and my wife about what to do if they're doing something that's potentially dangerous. So,
right.
So my wife's point of view is always, let them fall, let them get hurt, and then they'll learn the lesson. And I like that approach in general, But I draw a line where I say, no, that's getting too dangerous. Let me enforce some rules here so maybe they don't have to get hurt. So I think there's a balance here, because you and I are talking about, and other people that I've interviewed, and if people go through your courses and they read blogs or they listen to podcasts, they're going to listen to advice, right? Don't do this or do this. And they may not understand what it is. So it's always a good idea, if you're not sure, to try it. And then if you fall flat on your face, then you know, okay, this is not good. So you learn a lesson. That's very good. But sometimes I think it's beneficial to listen to people who have been there and just maybe take their word on it, because a lot of times you could save yourself so much trouble, so much heartache, if you could just, you know, avoid the really big problems.
Yeah.
And something that, you know, I wish I had, because, you know, and you were mentioning that as a new developer or as just a young person, you're full of self-confidence sometimes and you're like, I know everything.
And yep.
I've suffered from that. I still suffer from that. And I just want to believe my own experiences, but sometimes it's better. So we're not going to go into this, but there are patterns and there are anti-patterns, right? And so there's, when you're looking at software development, there are some things that we know a good ways of building software. And these are just, they're just bad, right? They're not always bad, but they're generally bad. So I think it's good to have that knowledge. And the best way to do that is to listen to podcasts, watch YouTube videos, and read blog posts and all of that stuff that's out there that Jeremy Clark and people like him are putting out. So Jeremy, do you recommend any podcasts, YouTube channels, or any other places on the internet where people can find that wonderful information?
Yeah. See, this is the problem, is there's a lot of good stuff out there and a lot of bad stuff out there. I actually do like Pluralsight as a resource, just because, again, they do go through that vetting process. It's not looking for a random video on YouTube. It's now curated content where people have said, okay, let's make sure we have people who know how to teach a topic, and let's make sure that we're not confusing. Another thing Pluralsight does that I really like is they don't have multiple courses on the same topic. So you don't have to go out and say, oh, well, there's like 32 courses on how to do Angular 2, you know, or Angular 5 or Angular 17 or whatever it's up to. They're all either more targeted or there's like one overview course and then a lot of specific courses. So you don't have like seven overview courses to try to pick from. So if you're a video learner, I really highly recommend Pluralsight. Now, unfortunately, I'm not a video learner, and I figured out that my brain doesn't work at the same speed as video. Basically, my brain speeds up and slows down as things interest me, and video runs at a constant speed, even if I can speed it up. So I found, for me, print media is the best way for me to learn, whether it's blog articles or books. I'm still one of those people who likes paper books because I can flip back and forth on the pages. So I would say find out kind of the best way that you learn, whether it's video learning or reading or tutorials that, you know, you do step by step following along, or, you know, attending live presentations or one-on-one mentoring, and see if you can get yourself into that environment where you're going to learn the best. Again, I'm kind of a book person, so I kind of talk to my friends. You know, now that I have a lot of resources in the community, I can kind of see what other people are doing and recommending, and that's kind of what I do. Unfortunately, I don't have like a here's the be all and end all, go to this place and learn sort of a thing.
Yeah, that's good to know. Pluralsight is very good. You can check out Jeremy's courses, and if you like, we can put the links to your courses, Jeremy, on our webpage for this podcast, for this episode, is going to be mentoringdevelopers.com/episode67. And we'll have show notes with all the transcript for our interview here and links. And you can add links if you want to. If you have any promo codes or anything else, feel free to share that with our audience. And then we'll make sure that it's on that page.
Yep, I'll make sure to get you those links.
Awesome. So finally, before we close, it's been a lengthy interview, I have to say. And I'm really grateful to you to giving us so much of your time today. But before we close, I still have a couple interesting questions that I think our audience could benefit from. And it's one of the things I noticed is that you're focused on .NET. .NET is not one technology, is a suite of technologies, as we know. But it doesn't appear to be that you have diverged from your focus much, which is a very good thing. But I wonder if that's true. I want you to talk a little bit about how you keep up with things or how you pick new technologies to learn. What do you look at? What's your criteria? And finally, also give some advice on that, how to learn new things to our listeners.
So the first thing to understand is I cannot know everything. And that was a hard lesson for me to learn. So I really do think about what do I want to focus on. And part of that is, again, I do like to attend user groups and code camps and, kind of those community events and talk to people and find out what technologies people are using, what's interesting, what's exciting. And so kind of what I do is I say what makes me happy. So kind of the current world, I've really kind of developed an interest in machine learning and functional programming. So I've been heading in that direction. And even though I talked about, using F# earlier, I actually started learning Haskell for functional programming. And the primary reason I did that is because I said, well, I want to get out of the .NET environment so I don't confuse functional bits with .NET bits. So kind of get into a pure functional, kind of knowing that most of the work I would be doing would probably be in the F# world. But I've also, kind of dabbled in Scala and a couple other things and seen some really cool stuff out there that I haven't had time to dabble in. So kind of when people are saying, well, what technology should I learn, Jeremy? I usually kind of have a couple different things to explore. The first thing is there a particular industry that makes you excited? Do you want to be in medical devices? Do you want to be in entertainment? Do you want to be in finance? If there's a particular industry you want to be in, go and find out what technologies they're specifically using and, start exploring those. So that's one direction that you can go if you're looking for a particular industry. Another thing you can say is, okay, well, what types of programming am I most interested in? Do I like the hardcore server-side computational stuff? Do I like the UI design and presentation and trying to figure out how to interact with my users? Do I like kind of that service communication, service bus stuff that's kind of in the middle, and then kind of take a look at what is available in those worlds, So like I love XAML as a UI technology and, it's desktop based and, people might see that as limiting, but there's a lot of desktop Windows machines out there. And then for people who are like broader, reach, obviously the web is the hugest reach we have. And so, if you're doing client-side JavaScript programming for presentation logic, that's a huge area to explore. So either focus on, an industry or a technology that makes you happy. And I try to encourage people to do things that they love because yes, we all do need jobs, but we need to also, figure out how to make our lives fulfilling at the same time and hopefully not just drudgery. So, did that answer the question? I feel like I'm talking in circles.
I think that it's a great answer because it's hard to answer a question like this because we want to know how you pick technology. There's just so many things that excite you. But I think there's also this aspect of you're thinking what industry you want to go into because where's the money? Because ultimately, if you learn something, you can do something for fun, or you may say, okay, I want to do this professionally. So if I want to do this particular type of thing, then I need to learn these three sets of technologies because that's how I can do that thing. So it becomes a means to an end. So people have different motivations. But if you're just starting out, if you're a new developer, or if you're a young person looking to establish yourself, then I would encourage you to focus on things that will get you a job. Focus on things that will get you noticed, right? And because you need to make your mark. And then once you have done that, then I would say it's okay to branch out into things that interest you, but perhaps you don't know how to use those technologies or how they will help you in forming your career. Because initially, getting yourself established, the first 4 or 5 years are the difficult ones. After that, in our industry, it's hard to find senior people. So I think it gets easier with time.
Oh, yeah, it definitely does. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I would say that pretty much JavaScript is the place to be right now as far as demand. But, you know, as if there's a lot of corporate developers out there, .NET and Java, those are huge in the corporate industry, you know, so it might also depend on what part of the country you're in. So if you're in like the Silicon Valley area, a lot of open source technologies and maybe more, I don't want to say more niche languages, but some that aren't quite as widespread are actually the things to look at. But, you know, if you're working at a bank, you know what, they're going to be using Java or .NET for a lot of the stuff on the back end. So, and there's a lot of corporate jobs out there, you know, and it's, you know, like I said, I was a corporate developer for 11 years. I am totally proud of that. And I think there is nothing wrong with it.
So how can people get in touch with you, Jeremy?
So I'm Jeremy Bytes pretty much everywhere online. So my website, jeremybytes.com, B-Y-T-E-S, and also on Twitter. And, you know, like I mentioned, I do quite a bit of speaking. So I travel the U.S. and venture out internationally from time to time. So I can be found there. And then on my website, jeremybytes.com, there's also links to my YouTube channel where I have some screencasts on various topics as well as my Pluralsight courses. So that's pretty much the one place to go to find where I'm going to be.
All right. Jeremy Bytes everywhere on the internet. That's a good lesson in branding. And I'm so excited to have Jeremy here and be able to talk to him at length about a lot of the questions that our audience has. And if you are listening to this podcast and you're really, really excited about learning and you want to learn more about Jeremy or you want to check out his courses, or if you want to see a number of our other guests, our previous guest was Reuven Lerner. We talked about regular expressions and he's an expert in that. If you're interested in any of these technologies and just want to know how to get started, feel free to send me an email, us@mentoringdevelopers.com, us@mentoringdevelopers.com. You can also tweet at us @mentoringdevs and just let us know what you think about this episode. And if there's a particular person you want us to talk to, we'd like to pursue that as well. All right, Jeremy, thank you so much for giving us your time.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Hi, folks. It's really good to know that you made it to the end of this episode. Did you enjoy listening to it? Did you have any questions that you wanted to ask or maybe some suggestions? Fire me an email at us@mentoringdevelopers.com and I'll see to it that it gets responded. Also, go ahead and sign up for the email list if you have not done that already. Go to mentoringdevelopers.com and you'll be able to sign up for email list. And once you do, I'll send you my 5 steps to success as a software developer. And also send you information about salary negotiations and how to get better salaries. And you can ask me any questions you want over there, and I'll be able to answer it through email personally. Also, if you're interested in getting a free t-shirt about diversity that I've designed, then go ahead and ask me a question. If your question is good and it gets featured on the podcast, you will be eligible to win a free t-shirt. A pretty cool t-shirt, if I may say myself. Once again, thanks for listening and stay in touch.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.